Welcome to A Closer Look, a KSKA presentation that takes us beyond the daily headlines and offers insight into the events and people who shape our community. I'm Lori Townsend. This half hour, we'll hear from three Alaskans who have new books out, Craig Medrid, Heather Lendy, and Charles Woolforth. Even though the snow is gone in Anchorage, Alaskans can never seem to get enough of the Iditarod. Craig Medrid's new book takes a unique look at the last great race. Most Iditarod reporters like to focus on the lead mushers, the slick teams up front that make the rugged 1,000-mile race to Nome look easy. But Medrid has always been fascinated by the mushers who struggle along the way and are eventually forced to abandon their dream. During this year's race, he collected the most heartbreaking stories of defeat in a book called Graveyard of Dreams, Dashed Hopes and Shattered Aspirations Along Alaska's Iditarod Trail. Medrid followed the race on Snow Machine, which he says was its own adventure.
Probably shouldn't say this, but some of the funnest parts were when I could just kind of be away from everyone and take off and spend time on the snow machine by myself and have quiet moments out there. And I think everyone in the race shares that. And if the book lacks anything, is it doesn't quite capture how it's this odd combination of a social event and an antisocial event, in that I think everyone likes being away from everyone else, but then they all kind of like being together too. So it's kind of a commentary on the human animal that, you know, we really don't like people, but we have to have people.
Give us some examples of why mushers were forced to give up this year.
You know, incompetence would be a very unkind word, so I won't use it, but there's an inability, there's a lack of functioning at a kind of an animal level that we're just not used to dealing in that world or with the problems of dogs every day. And I think most of the people who failed, it just kind of became an overwhelming task to keep the dogs functioning, to keep the dogs happy, to live with the dogs, which, I mean, to somebody like Rick Swenson or Martin Boozer is really easy, but it's not simple to make a bunch of dogs into your family. I mean, it's they have different little personalities, they have different little needs, they don't always get along. It's like having 16 3-year-olds, and your job is to keep them all kind of working together every day. And it can be overwhelming.
Did you find that mushers who were failing, were they willing to tell their stories?
Yeah, they all want to tell their stories. I mean, it's kind of the nature of journalism. If you've been in this business as long as I have, which sometimes seems like too long, when people's hearts are broken, they want to tell their stories. I mean, everyone wants to tell their story, and often, you're kind of conflicted about getting them to do that. It often makes it better for them to tell their story. In fact, it almost always makes them better to unburden themselves and just tell their story. So, yeah, I found them very cooperative and very, very, very willing to talk, even in some very difficult circumstances. In fact, a couple cases when I just kind of like stopped the interview because it was really more than I wanted to know. It was almost too personal as to how involved people were.
Craig, you write a lot about Iditarod or mushing addiction in the book. How real a phenomenon do you think this is? And why does this particular sport have the power that it does over people?
Well, I think it's a very real addiction, and I think a whole bunch of people admitted that. And I write about old David Azen Brave from Talkeetna, Isle. He used to live in Willow, I think, did it seven or eight times, never did make it. And I think the most revealing thing wasn't talking to him, that when he finally decided, and he's in his 70s now, that he had to quit, he had to sell everything. I mean, he couldn't just sell the dogs and the harnesses and the sleds. He had to sell the dog houses and everything and move, because the draw to go back was so strong that he was afraid that if he looked out there and saw an empty doghouse, he'd get a dog to put in the doghouse and it would all start again. It's a very serious addiction, and I don't know, it's hard to describe why. It's like most addictions. I think part of it is the fascination with the romanticism of it. I think part of it is that the dogs grow on you. I mean, we all know how dogs are. Every one of us who has a dog, you you start treating it like family. If you get a whole bunch of them and you're treating them like family and you get this idea they all want to go on this adventure to Nome, you feel bad if you don't take them. You feel bad if they don't make it. You know, there's been a lot of criticism of the Iditarod and how, you know, people abuse dogs, blah, blah, blah. It's more like the dogs abuse people. I mean, people really get to believe that the dogs want to get there. And I've seen people who quit who honestly, you know, felt really bad that they'd let their dogs down because they'd had to quit, which I was kind of like, no, you didn't let the dogs down. They really don't care one way or the other.
So, Craig, how crazy do you think someone has to be to even attempt this race, the Iditarod?
I don't know. It's being romantic crazy. You have to be a romantic. You have to have that vision of Jack London and Sergeant Preston and all those kinds of things. And I don't know if those people are crazy. And if they're crazy, is it a good crazy or a bad crazy? I mean, it's a good thing to have dreams. It's a wonderful thing to have dreams. As someone who loves dogs, I think it's kind of cool to love dogs. You know, I think it's wonderful that people dream about doing it. Now, whether or not some of them should do it, that's another matter. But, crazy's not a bad thing.
Craig Medrid is a writer for AlaskaDispatch.com. His book, Graveyard of Dreams, is available through Amazon.com. I'm Laurie Townsend, and you're listening to A Closer Look with three Alaskan authors who have new books out. 5 years ago, Haynes writer Heather Lendy was supposed to be on tour promoting her first book. Instead, she was recovering from a horrific bike accident that crushed her pelvis. The local grocery store manager didn't see her at an intersection and ran her over with his truck. Now she's fully recovered and beginning a tour for her newest collection of essays, Take Good Care of the Garden and the Dogs. The book begins with the story of her bike crash. Lendy says it didn't take her long to start writing about the accident.
A couple of days, actually, because I was in the hospital in Seattle, and a friend brought me a laptop. And, at that time I was writing a column for the Anchorage Daily News, and I missed one because my deadlines were Tuesdays, and I was hit on a Thursday, and I was a little bit, you know, still kind of out of it by then, but I made the next one. And I found that I couldn't really concentrate very well between all the stuff that was going on. And so I had to write in a more organized way, like a little bit every day for 4 or 5 days, and then kind of read it and try to put it together as some sort of a column.
Did you question at all whether or not you wanted to write about it?
No, actually. I write about a lot of things, obviously. My life is sort of an open book. And in a way, it was really healing because it was the only thing I could do. I mean, I couldn't move. And it was just easier to be able to write things down.
How was it different writing about the accident for this book after a few years had passed versus writing about the accident just weeks after it happened for the Anchorage Daily News?
Well, you know, you can sort of put things into a little bit of perspective. And the book is kind of an expansion of sort of what I learned through my kind of healing process. And a lot of it had to do with faith and family and community and those sort of things. And so I focused on other people in Haynes that had, you know, that believed certain things healed them and why. And so I write about Tim June, that some people might know him as a sort of an environmental activist. And the reason is that he had cancer when he was a young man, and he walked away from his cancer treatments and came to Alaska thinking that he would either die or get better. And he's, you know, in his 50s now and better. And so he really believes the environment healed him, and thus that changed the way he lived. And I write about Wayne Price, who carved a totem pole that he believed will help heal what ails some of the things in the Tlingit culture, but really in all of Alaskan culture, you know, the issues of violence and alcohol addiction and some of those things. And the pole worked for a lot of people, and it continues to. You know, when you see it, the title works. You know, the title is You're Going to Be Well, or the name of the pole is You Are Going to Get Well. And when you see it standing there in front of the Mount Edgecombe Hospital in Sitka, something good happens to you. So, you know, those kind of things were things that I could look at as time went on and sort of try to figure out what makes other people tick. Why do some people get better? Not necessarily, I didn't really look into why some people don't, but I kind of looked at what happens with people and how our faith or our belief in certain things helps us.
The recovery lasted many months, and that's something you don't talk as much about in the book. Is there a reason for that?
Well, I mean, I don't know. You kind of don't want to just dwell on all the stuff about you. You know, my a lot of the book is about my mother. The title comes from her kind of last request, and I still get a little embarrassed with the kind of the work I do, because, you know, my mother was one of those people like, is there someone else you can talk about besides yourself today? So you know, there's a point where you use the things that happen to you as an introduction, but you don't want to, like, okay, you know, every single thing you don't really need to know. You can kind of summarize it and then go to the next thing. So
have you been able to make a full recovery?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as much as anybody does. I mean, I think we've all, by the time you get to be 50 years old, have been hit by the proverbial truck, if not the physical truck. And, you know, things happen and you change. And I don't know whether complete recovery is right. Sure, I walk and I run and I do stuff, but I'm a different person because of what happened. Just like people are different who have survived breast cancer or a child in trouble or, you know, a terrible divorce. You're different. And in some ways, at least for me, I found better. I'm more grateful than I was before. Not that this isn't a really good way to get grateful. Don't go play in the traffic here in Anchorage. But still, it's you know, there's something really empowering about surviving getting run over by a truck, or for that matter, the worst thing you could think could happen to you. And it I think it generates a kind of gratitude.
On your blog, you talk about how important the Hickel family was in your recovery, and also in your ability to forgive the man who ran over you. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah, I didn't, I write about it in the book, but I didn't want to say anything in the book because I didn't want to be like name dropping, you know, Alaskans. But Mrs. Hickel, Ermalee, she always says to call her Ermalee. I still call her Mrs. Hickel. I'm not a close friend of the family or anything, but Ermalee used to read my daily news column and send me little notes. And when I was here reading about the first book, she raised her hand and asked me if I had seen Kevin, you know, the guy that ran me over. And I had said no, you know, that I hadn't really. I mean, I said hi and everything. And I told her, you know, I forgave him and there was no issues really. And then she's very polite, as you know, who know Mrs. Hickel. And she said, well, you know, I really think maybe that you should. And I said, oh, you know, I kind of will. And then I had lunch with her and she explained more that she really thought I ought to do that. And I assured her that I would. And then she wrote me a note. She wrote me a nice little letter reminding me about a month later and had I done this. And she told me to go to the grocery store and give Kevin a big hug. And that was what I needed to do. And I'm really not a hugger. You know, I'm kind of an Episcopalian. This was just like, really? But the more I thought about it, I you know, she was right. And so that moment happened, and it was really a good thing to do. And I'm glad that I did it. And I'm glad that such a wise, good woman talked me into doing that. And I hope that I can grow up to be as just good and smart, I think, as she is. And also, there was a really great one that when I was hurt, she also wrote me and said that one way to make myself feel good, even when I was lying in bed, was to raise my arms up and say, hip, hip, hooray, hip, hip, hooray, today is a wonderful day. And she said that she and Governor Hickel did that every morning to start the day. And she said, trust me, this will make you feel happy just thinking of us doing it. And it did. See, it's making you happy now. I mean, it just makes you laugh, doesn't it? It's like a wonderful image of them doing this. And I believe it. And I used it and it made me feel better every day.
So, I can see why I would.
Of course. Just think of that. It's a great story. And it's true.
In the midst of your recovery, your mother's cancer got worse. What was it like to still be recovering yourself while you needed to take care of someone else, especially your mom?
It was really a challenge. I mean, it was really hard. And again, though, I think it's one of the things that helped me get better because, you know, the surest way, I think, to recover from things, to do things physically, to say, you know, not sort of say, well, I'm tired, I got to go to bed now, is when you're caring for other people, and whether it's your children or your parents or whatever. And so I really think that in a way that was sort of the final step to getting on my feet, to just, you know, thinking, I can't fly across the country. I can't sit for a half an hour. It hurts. Well, I've got to get on a plane to New York, you know, again, and then come back again. And then, you know, when you do it. And I think when I was throughout the whole process, people said to me, oh, you know, you were so brave and you did all these, how did you do it? And I said, well, what choice do you have, really? I mean, if you've got a bunch of children, you have parents, you have people that are depending on you. You can't just stay in bed. I mean, you have to. And I think by having to, then you get well. Or at least I did, and in the type of injuries that I had. I'm not saying that just because you will it, you can, you know, that's, and I think those are some of the questions from the book. My mom also really wanted to get better, and that just didn't happen. And she was also a very faithful person, and, you know, went to church every Sunday and Bible study a lot, and she still didn't get better, or at least didn't get better in our version of it. Who knows if that's a grander scheme of things, but... You know, so it's not like that. I'm not saying just because I had this willpower it happened, but all those kind of questions come up throughout the book. There's just sort of a thread of, gee, how come?
Do you think your accident changed how you helped your mother through the end of her life, or how you thought about that experience?
Yes and no. Part of the thing that happened when I got hurt was people took care of me, in very, you know, sort of intimate ways, you know, bedpans and such. And, through that, I, in a kind of karmic way, decided to give back some and became a hospice volunteer. And I did the training and got very involved in some of those things. As I was getting better, I was learning about that. And so then when my mother was dying of cancer, I had that to fall back on, and I understood a little more, maybe some of the emotions that go on with a family and the dynamics and even of the person that's dying, and how you kind of have to let people do it their way. And so in that way, the accident helped. And I think also in the way where you understand yourself when you've been through something really hard, you give people a little more slack than you might have if you never had, you know? And yeah, there were things that that my mother did that I wouldn't have done, or that I wished to happen differently, but I would never have told her that or tried to push her to do it any differently. I mean, it's really her journey, just like mine was mine. And I think when you're faced with your own mortality, you've got to let people do it their way. It's the only control they've got. And if you start pushing and pulling, that doesn't make anything any better.
Mm-hmm. How have these experiences impacted your life in Haines? Do you view your life there in the community differently or in a new way?
Well, I mean, sure, part of it. I mean, getting it was almost like the notes and the cards and stuff. And right after I got hurt, it was almost like being at your own funeral and people saying nice things about you. So that was very nice. I think now the bloom is off the rose and I'm back to being like regular Heather again. But, you know, so it was neat, you know, at one point you felt like, gee, like Sally Fields. Hey, they like me, you know. But I just really appreciate more the things that people in my community do, you know, from Fireman Al Badgley, you know, who, and the volunteer EMT people, to the, you know, the local pastors, to even just, you know, people that can cook a great meal like in 2 minutes and get it to your house, like warm with all kinds of stuff that are good for you that just can do this. You know, there's a lot of very capable people in Haines that do very good things. And it's nice to live in that kind of community. And I hadn't been on the receiving end before. I was in the little army of people that go off and help. And you just don't realize what a huge, huge impact just coming over to someone's house and sitting there for a few hours so everybody else in the family can get a break can be.
When your first book came out, the accident canceled your book tour. So what's it like to be heading out on a tour this time around?
I'm driving very carefully now that I'm in Anchorage. I keep sort of waiting for a safe to fall on my head. I've been a little nervous about the whole thing, actually. I wasn't going to ride my bicycle at all until after it got over. And I have been, but only with my husband at like 5 o'clock in the morning. So it's different. And this book is a much more intimate book, I think. And also, the last book, when I kind of went out, everybody was happy to see me, you know, because I was standing up. Now it's just, you know, you're the way you are. So it's the other thing, too, I realize is I think as a, you know, experienced author of all of two books, the first one was so exciting, like I thought it was going to change my life. And it didn't really. Actually, some really bad things happened. So now the second one, I don't have as much, you know, I don't have as much invested in it, I guess. I do and I don't, but I you know, it's exciting and it makes me happy, but it's exciting and makes me happy at home. It's not just going out and doing the tour thing, which before was a bigger deal to me, and then I didn't get to have it happen anyway. So there's some kind of big lesson there.
How about the people in Haines? This is your second book, which I think is huge. It's amazing to me to accomplish finishing one book is a large feat, but two, are people starstruck? Do they treat you differently now?
No, nobody's starstruck at all. As I was leaving, my biggest project this week was I had to get the library director evaluation done because I'm on the library board, and that was kind of pressing on me. And then the garden in, and we had the second grade over for the school picnic yesterday because my daughter teaches second grade. And, you know, there's those kind of things. I coach the cross country team. I'm a hospice volunteer. I was a little sleepy staying up overnight with a friend that needed some help. So, you know, those, I don't think so. I don't think anybody is at all. I mean, I think if anything, they're kind of like, huh, I'll be darned. You know, I just hope they don't read it and think I'm like completely crazy and that they don't want me to coach their kids anymore or, you know, volunteer at the library. But, no, I think, and I also think that's because I live in a community with a lot of really talented and accomplished artists. And I might be a literary one, but I live amongst a town with 150 or so people that can paint and carve and do silver and that are all really, a lot of them are really, really good and have had in their own ways probably more success than I have out there. So I think, I don't know, I think we kind of expect a lot of people in Haines.
Heather Lendy's new book is called Take Good Care of the Garden and the Dogs. You're listening to A Closer Look, interviews with three Alaskan writers on their new books. Anchorage author Charles Woolforth has always been fascinated by the conflicted relationship humans have with the planet. It's a topic he examines in his new book, The Fate of Nature, Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. Woolforth says, researching the book, he learned the best environmental decisions are often made at the local level.
And I think that's almost an Alaska truism. The fishermen tried to get double-hulled tankers in Prince William Sound before the pipeline was built. They were overruled by the federal government, by the courts. And if that Exxon Valdez had been a double-hulled tanker, it would have turned out very differently. So a lot of times these things will bubble up from the bottom level. And this is where, you know, I'm not a Tea Partier and I'm not a conservative, not from that point of view, but I think there is something to be said for going back to the concept of federalism, where local people get more power over their own communities. With power comes responsibility and a desire to care. And I don't think that these big national solutions often work very well.
The spill in the Gulf will have environmental ripple effects for decades. Even though the book was written before this blowout, you covered the Exxon Valdez. How do these things factor in?
To me, it points to the need to look at this more systematically. I'm not interested in politicians telling me we're going to get better blowout preventers, we're going to get more boom, we're going to do a better job next time. We've already heard that before. What we need to start talking about is changing the system by which we relate to the environment, not saying we need new politicians in the same offices, but saying we need things like Regional Citizens Advisory Council in Prince William Sound, which has worked. So the other thing you see is just like in Prince William Sound, everybody all over the country uses the oil, but the people who pay the price for the disaster are those local people. Same thing in the Gulf of Mexico. We all use the oil, and we all feel bad about the spill, but the ones who are really paying the price are those fishermen and those motel owners down on the shore of the Gulf of Mexico. And so they really ought to have the power to protect themselves beforehand.
What did you discover in the Native community as they became corporate owners? How or has it changed the tenets of environmental awareness and concern?
Well, I think that, you know, the whole story of the Alaska Native Claims Land Act is such a long and complex one. But a really deep part of it is this change into a corporate culture, which is really, I think most ANCSA CEOs would tell you, is really incompatible with Native culture and with Native lifeways. It's Oliver Levitt, who is the former chairman of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, told me, we live in Nupiaq lifeway. Then when we get in the boardroom, we live the corporate competitive way, and that's how it has to work because that's the world they're in. When it comes to dealing with natural resources, I don't think that's served a lot of Native corporations really well. I look at the way timber was treated in Southeast Alaska during the big NOL sales as it was being liquidated, and I don't think that really reflected the philosophy of those cultures as those trees were liquidated. And you hear them defend it, and I'm sure that's a controversial point of view, and people will be offended by it. What do I have to interpret their philosophies? But I've spent a lot of time in Native communities, and I've talked to elders, and I think I understand what the basic philosophy of that lifeway is. And I don't think it has to do with liquidating your resources and selling them overseas. So there is an incompatibility there, and it's obviously a huge struggle, and it's really one of the biggest stories of Alaska culture in the future, of how those are resolved.
And how about personally, Charles? What did you learn in this research and writing? Were you surprised to learn there's more concern than not, or disappointed to learn that there is less among people you interviewed?
I would say it's very rare to find somebody who doesn't feel a real connection to nature and to wildlife and a real desire to see it survive on this planet. And that is ultimately what gives me hope. We all discount that. We all discount our positive feelings and our positive desire to do good for the world and think of, well, that's not the real world or that's not real human nature. But, if we all feel that way, then there's something real there. And I really think it's a matter of changing our systems and our relationships and our society to where some of more of our positive wishes really are carried through. I think it's as simple as that. And in that way, it comes down to every single individual and how we relate to each other, how we build communities, and how our communities relate to nature.
This has been A Closer Look on KSKA, a production of APTI News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage. I'm Lori Townsend. Thank you for listening.